Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today on Morning Edition with Gary Ellenbolt, Tristan Harris at the Center for Humane Technology talked about the dangers of internet addiction and proposed a new model for access. This afternoon on All Things Considered with Jeremy Ludeman, tune in for thoughts on what happens when artificial intelligence gets things wrong. And of course, we all remember dramatic images of people in Hawaii running for their lives, or so they thought, when they were mistakenly warned of an incoming ballistic missile on January 13th. Joseph Bottom is director of the Classics Institute. It's a think tank at Dakota State University that explores the promises and dangers of computer technology. He recently wrote a piece for the Weekly Standard called The Immorality of Bad Software Design. He joins us now on the phone from Madison. Joseph Bottom, welcome back to In the Moment.
Thanks for having me.
It seems like immorality of bad design is certainly an eye-catching headline. Before we dig into how it applies, let's set the scene for people who don't remember. So it's a Saturday morning, a little after 8 o'clock. You're in Hawaii, and your phone lights up with an emergency alert. And then it turns out to be fake, and people start unpacking. Everything gets blamed on this one guy, essentially. Tell us how it sort of unfolded after the mistake was made, and people started looking at how the software was actually designed.
Well, it took them 40 minutes to issue another email, voice, text mail, sign flashing on the highway. I mean, these signs, Lori, were flashing on the highway. There, you know, those road signs with the orange lights and the black background saying,
right,
incoming missile, find shelter, this is not a drill. And, you know, people were driving off the roads, the 9/11 calls, there were thousands, the whole system was swamped. It took them 40 minutes to get a new message out that, it was a drill, and that the message had been sent in error. The governor insisted that he be the first to tweet out the news that it was a false alarm, but it took him 20 minutes because he couldn't remember his password for Twitter. And they had to find somebody in his office who knew it. It was a comedy of errors,
right,
Lori, but it was a comedy of errors made possible by a simply badly designed system. And what struck me, the reason I wrote that piece, there was so much written about it and mockery and in magazines across the nation, and I began to feel uncomfortable with that mockery, with the whole way it was being treated, because it struck me very few people are talking about the moral and the immoral, the ethical and the unethical, when we speak about computers and our lives with computers and the people who present us with computer programs. And I wanted to take as strong a line as I possibly could and say, you know what? A badly designed program isn't just ugly, and it isn't just awkward. It's actually immoral. Hmm. It steals time from us when we don't have time to be stolen. It raises the bar, the learning bar, which introduces new hurdles to bring people into the workforce, which is immoral. And finally, when it goes catastrophically wrong, and millions of people in Hawaii were put in fear of their lives. And no one seemed to be describing that as something terribly immoral to have done. It was bad. It was socially awkward. The governor finally insisted that the head of the agency step down, which he did 2 days ago. And they finally fired the guy who had actually sent out the message, I think, 3 days ago. But, you know, no one was framing this in moral terms. And it struck me, not only do we need to think about our lives, our computerized lives, in moral terms, but we have to expand that, because computers now occupy such a large portion of our social condition, of our personal experience, that we have to ask ourselves not just what works and what doesn't, what is efficient or inefficient, what is awkward and what is easy. We have to ask ourselves what is good and what is bad.
Who's making those decisions? Are we, you know, is it just the designers who are having to ask those things, or can we as consumers, can we as, you know, people who are trying to apply for a job and can't because they can't figure out the job application software or links from a company? Whose responsibility is it to ask those questions? All of us?
I think all of us. It's something we will have to work out. And we have let 40 years of the computer revolution go by without working it out. And that seems to be our problem. You know, the state procurement system in Hawaii got this system, apparently, we don't have full confirmation, but nearly everyone agrees it's from an Idaho company called AlertSense. And I've seen the interface for the program that AlertSense sold the procurement office of the Hawaiian state government. And it's awful. It's a mess. The language is the language on your links on the menus that you pull down are terms that would make sense to the programmers of the program, but would make no sense to the people using the program. And that's a perfect example of what I mean by immoral at every stage. It's immoral because it uses up time that these people could be, the users could be putting to other ends. It's immoral because everybody employed by the Hawaiian alert system had to undergo something like 40 hours of training. And the reason they had to undergo 40 hours of training is because the system was so bad it required 40 hours to get to know how to use what is, in computer terms, a very simple piece of software. And finally, it was immoral because the consequences of getting it wrong were so catastrophic. There were heart attacks, and more to the point, to put someone in fear of their lives is, under the common law, a major crime.
And there's a future risk, too. If this happened in South Dakota tomorrow and you were driving down the road and saw that sign, there would be part of you that would say, this is maybe not true.
You know, I hadn't added that in the article in the Weekly Standard, but I think you're absolutely right, and I've thought of it since then. And we might describe that as the boy who cried wolf problem.
Right.
You've heard it, you know, so it must not be true, because it wasn't true the last time and maybe the time before. And the trouble, Lori, with that story of the boy who cried wolf is that eventually the wolf actually comes.
Right. What about this notion of the governor not having his Twitter password and sort of the delay in correcting things? Or how do you unpack that a little bit? Well, once the mistake was made, why did it take so long? It has to be more complicated than, you know, the governor just holding the line.
Right. The actually sending out the alert to say that our previous alert was not correct required so many steps through the software. They had to write a template, which is what the software called it, for a new message, had to first be defined as a template, then saved as a template, then a message composed under the new template, which doesn't have a name yet. And it was just step after step, and that's what took them 40 minutes to get out the official alert that went out to all the cell phones in the Hawaii and the highway signs again. The fact that the state government wasn't using every platform available other than that to get the news out came from the fact that the governor wanted to be the first one to do it. And so he said he would be the first. Everybody else had to wait, and then it took 20 minutes while they tried to guess his password on Twitter.
That's embarrassing.
It really is.
Really? Yeah.
It really is.
I mean,
I think not even South Dakota would we do that.
No. Let's hope. When you talk about sort of, you know, this is so compelling, but then also it broadens. And I mentioned in the introduction, you know, from morning to night here on NPR today, you can hear stories where people are starting to ask some of these questions about, you know, humane technology or, you know, the limitations of artificial intelligence. And you mentioned the immorality of stealing time and energy from daily work. And of course, my first thought, because it's my number one technology frustration, is email and how much time some of these technologies take, you know, during the workday, and what you miss if you're not thoroughly, you know, tapped into email 24/7. So this is a broader question as well about
all the things you have to delete in your email, Lori. I have a principle of cyber ethics, one of several I'm trying to develop, and it goes like this. The flagship is not the fleet. Again and again, we are sold new technology, new computerizations of our lives in the name of the best possible possible uses of it. So we're going to see new virtual simulations emerging that use the ear, the nerves in the ear, to create a simulacrum of sight. And it's really wonderful, and that's the best possible use. And of course we're going to want this new technology. But once everybody gets it, the uses are not going to prove that high moral wonderful use. A perfect example is email, in which, you know, which was originally developed so Army scientists could talk to each other in the ARPANET, the first uses of email, and then developed into this wonderful form of almost instantaneous communication. And then we found, once everybody got it, that to this day, 40% of the traffic of emails, a huge burden on the internet backbone, is spam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we could do the same thing with Facebook and this group technology that's emerged. We could do the same thing with every new technology to point out that we're sold it in the name of its wonders. And then we discover once you have 100% or near 100% usage of it, my 105-year-old grandmother in Pierce, South Dakota, uses email.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone uses it, just about. And the thing is, you know, every one of these new technologies comes with downsides, comes with disadvantages, comes with the potential for immorality, and we never stop and consider that at the beginning. And we don't, in fact, stop to consider it until you and I and the other people you're going to be talking with today and that are going to be on NPR, until the technology is already so well established that one is virtually spitting in the wind to oppose it.
Right. I was going to say my brother's 40 and he does not have email, still does his banking in person. And I often wonder, you know, what's at risk for him to sort of live a life like that. If you decide that you want to sort of forego, you know, he has a flip phone. What happens to you in this
right.
society?
Well,
and what are the moral implications of leaving someone
behind? Laurie, and I
yeah.
think, you know, one of the things we're going to have to consider that we have not yet is that any sane society is going to contain the possibility to opt out.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't opt out, if you were just brushed aside and forgotten by the society, if you try and opt out, then we have a society which is selling the worst features of the cyber revolution. You know, we don't have to go all the way to, you know, hesitations. My banker, the Wells Fargo, the teller there, told me I didn't have to bring in this check to deposit it. I could just take a photograph of it with my phone and mail it to them.
Right.
And then tear up the check afterwards.
Right.
And I found myself, I'm so old, Laurie, I found myself really uncomfortable with that.
Right. So you know, is it our response? I mean, again, it's all of our responsibilities to have the conversation, but I'm wondering as a parent, like, is it this generation, you know, those of us who remember a time without this technology, to hold firm and say, no, we're not going to use it, we're not going to do it? Or is it our children's generation to sort of grow up into it and then opt out of it? And here's another example. I was with a group of high schoolers the other day, and we all went to Subway for a lunch. And they said, you know, you get a free cookie if you fill out this survey. And like five of those kids, by the time we were done with Subway, had filled out the survey, given all their, you know, whatever, email information or personal information, phone numbers, to Subway to get a free cookie. And they were excited to do so. And I thought, well, what are you trading for that free
exactly.
cookie? What's it worth?
And no one's. There's a rule here, another cyber ethical rule. If you are not the customer, if you're not paying money for something, then what you're selling is yourself. And that's what they sold. Mm. You know, Subway, they sold them their information. And
right.
I notice again and again, the young simply don't have a sense that that information is valuable.
Right.
Because they're so cybernetically connected. It strikes me that one of the single best things you can do is get your children off their computers, and in fact, don't allow your children to be connected. Steve Jobs was quite extraordinary moment when an interviewer, a lightweight interviewer, was asking, oh, you know, must be so wonderful to be in your family. Your kids must get all the latest toys. And Steve Jobs said, so it was the most obvious thing. Oh, I don't let my children use computers or cell phones.
Right.
And it seems to me that there's someone who understood in his time what this was doing to us and thought, well, my children will use them when they're 18 years old.
Right.
I'm strongly opposed to the pushing of computers into our grade schools or our junior high schools or even really our high schools. We have generations of children now who cannot write cursive but cannot read it. And have terrible handwriting because they text. That's their primary typing with their thumbs. And it strikes me that we need to teach them the alternative to the cybernetic connection and the machine that's eating them up. We need to teach them that there exists a world outside of that, and we need to teach it to them while they are young.
Right. Joseph Bottom, there is so much more to talk about, so I hope you will come back. You're always a great guest. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.